NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For centuries, it's how legions of American kids have been educated. 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year, they show up at a school building, attend classes, and get report cards. But is this longtime approach still working? Did it ever really work for everyone? Educators nationwide are now asking these questions as they explore what would happen if we threw out the blackboards and chalk and quieted those ringing classroom bells, jumped off that familiar academic calendar, and opened up school walls so students could pursue learning outside in the community. It's a big idea based on the belief that everyone learns differently and that true mastery of subject matter involves a lot more than time spent in a seat and a score on a test. Now, a new book called Off the Clock describes these efforts to shake up learning here in New Hampshire, efforts which have brought the state national praise. Just yesterday, federal officials came to New Hampshire honoring the state as the sole recipient of a national award for school innovation. Still, these changes can be easier said than done. For those involved in the daily nitty-gritty reality of education, there are many questions, from how much all this might cost to how to hold students accountable for learning what they need to know. Today in The Exchange, getting our schools off the clock. Let's hear from you. Do you see a need to shake up how education is structured, or do traditional schedules still work well? Are some of these changes underway in your schools already? If so, what's your opinion of them? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We're also on Facebook. You can go to our page, join the conversation there. We have two guests in studio with us, Fred Bramante, former chair of the New Hampshire Board of Education, co-author of the book I mentioned, Off the Clock, Moving Education from Time to Competency. And Fred, always nice to see you. Thank you for being
here.
Great
to see you, Laura.
Also with us, George Strout, Communications Coordinator for the New Hampshire Chapter of the National Education Association, and until recently, a high school math teacher. And George, nice to meet you, and thank you for your time this morning as well.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, and gentlemen, there's that old saying, if it isn't broken, don't fix it. So, Fred, what needs to be fixed, in your opinion?
It's broken. Public education, as we know it, was built for a different time. It was not structured so that, to bring every kid to mastery, to get every kid to learn. It was kind of a sorting mechanism to figure out who were the smartest ones so we could send them to college, and then we'll send the rest of the kids into the factories and and into the workforce. And so we really didn't need to educate all of our kids. Now we have to educate all of our kids, and so we can't have this sorting mechanism that ultimately caters to the learning styles of kids who learn well in a traditional classroom. My wife was one of those kids, one of those goody-goodies that got the gold star on her forehead all the time, did exactly what the teacher wanted her to do, got an A on the test. I was not one of those kids. School taught me that I wasn't very bright, and life taught me that school was wrong. And so I have dedicated my life to try to find a different way to, to make school so that it could work for every single kid.
Well, and we'll definitely get into, in just a minute, Fred, this idea about getting schools off the clock. Again, that's the name of the book that you co-authored. But, George, what do you think? I mean, we often hear it's almost a cliche to say schools are broken. I mean, what's broken and what isn't, in your opinion, as an educator?
It's funny. Almost anything is broken if you look at it, deep enough. I think as an educator, we have been changing for the last 10 years that I was teaching. It doesn't even look the same as it did in 2001 when I started to 2010 when I left. We do understand teachers understand everyone learns, but also everyone learns at a different rate, and they need different motivations sometimes, and they need different input from myself or other people who can help them. And it's amazing the kinds of schedules that we do come up with, the kinds of offerings we do come up with. There are already students, at least in Salem, who don't attend a full day, who actually do other things for credit or, to help them, the way they learn. I know the last class I taught, I had some students in there who might not have the best attendance record. So I worked very hard to put almost – well, everything online so that if they weren't there, they could find it. But they still had me as a resource when they came in. You know, you look at Harvard and MIT, they offer all of their coursework per se online, but exposure to it doesn't mean that you have actually absorbed it or mastered it. So, you know, I think teachers are always looking and schools are always looking for ways to do better with what we're given. And, you know, there's some interesting things in this book that I think a lot of us could agree to.
So you're saying, A, a lot of these changes are happening already.
Yes.
But is there a sense of brokenness or not then, George? What do you think?
You know, there's always a sense that we can do better. No matter what you're in, no matter what job you have, whether you're an educator, radio host, whatever you do, there's always a sense that we can do better. One of my favorite things at the end of watching Pardon the Interruption is, you know, they wave the flag, the Canadian flag, and, you know, we'll try to do better tomorrow. Yeah, we'll always try to do better tomorrow. So to say that we're always trying to do better is far different than saying something's broken, that we change the way people look at themselves. We change the way students look at the situation they're in. If all they hear is you're in a broken system, you're in a failing system. I don't think that helps. And so what we were trying to do when, as educators, is say there's always room for improvement. What are we doing right? What can we build on? What do we need to change? How is it going to help everyone? So I'm not really going to jump into it's broken. Everything can be improved.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the concepts that Fred raised in the book that New Hampshire's been looking at for a couple years now that, again, won us a pretty big national award just yesterday.
Absolutely.
You know, the only state to win that award.
And Laura, can I say something?
Sure.
We really won this thing 2 years in a row because the group that won it last year was the New England Secondary School Consortium. They stole our plan. And I say stole our plan, I say it lovingly, because ultimately the goal is for everybody in the country to steal our plan. So,
what's the basic idea, Fred, about getting schools off the clock?
In 2003, we started an effort to change the state regulations and put those regulations in place in 2005 and gave everybody until the 2008-2009 school year to move away from giving credit in high school for seat time for 135 class hours of instruction to get your A, B, C, D to a competency-based system. And
you have to prove mastery of a subject.
Mastery of required competencies. You know, when I talk to kids, I tell them, look, the way the old system works, you could get an A first quarter in addition, a B second quarter in subtraction, a C third quarter in multiplication, D or an F fourth quarter in division, and you can still pass the course. And you haven't learned multiplication and division, so why should we let you pass the course? If you go into the Air Force and you're going to learn to fly a plane, you get an A in taking off and you get an A in keeping the plane in the air, but you get a C, D, or an F in landing, they don't let you pass the course.
You're not doing so well.
No. So ultimately, and in Rose Colby, my co-author, she talks about in the book how, you know, ask high school math teachers about the kids that didn't learn fractions in the third grade and still don't understand fractions. So to me, it's not about time. It's not about, you know, you get to the end of the first quarter and here's your grade. You get to the end of the second quarter and here's your grade. Kids learn at different paces. They learn different ways. So ultimately, we have to move away from this batching of people inside of a classroom to ultimately a customized system for every single kid. And I will tell you that George is correct that we are, you know, he said that, you know, going back as far as, almost 10 years, because that's basically when we started this conversation. And I will tell you that people were doing things before that, too. In many cases, they were doing things that did not fit in the state regulations. They just weren't telling the Department of Education about it because they were afraid they would be told they can't do stuff like that. But then we blessed it and we said to them, look it, we want you offering all these opportunities out, you know, not just traditional classroom opportunities, but any way that a kid can learn. We blessed in the regulations for credit toward graduation, private instruction, independent study, online courses, internships, apprenticeships, any way that a kid can demonstrate that he or she has mastered the materials, they can now get credit in the state of New Hampshire. And George is right. We have a lot of schools that are moving in this direction, but we still have a long, long way to go.
All right. And I want to ask your thoughts too, George, and then so many questions about how this really works on the ground. But so what do you think, George? I mean, how easy is it to get schools off of that, you know, 7-8 hour a day clock, 5 days a week, 9 months a year? How do you get off of that?
Slowly. Unfortunately, I'm a big fan of the block scheduling in the high school because then I have 90 minutes
to spend with a
class and more time with people who have different rates. And if at the end of my clock time I'm done with that first semester, someone is still struggling, the entire year isn't gone. You know, then they can come back. There are other things that we can do in a block schedule to make sure that people have mastered that. And I completely agree. If you don't know fractions, you now have shut down in math, and it's not gonna work for you. But for me, it is that having that spirit of what can we do better? How are our students doing? Are schools measuring things? If we're not measuring how well our students are doing in meaningful ways, then I don't really know how I'm going to go improve. So we need to be following students. We need to be watching them individually. The last course I taught, we actually it was for credit. At the junior colleges, students took an Accuplacer at the beginning of the year. I was a little afraid of that because all of my students took a test before they saw me, and then they take a test after they saw me. But that's not my concern. I'm going to go teach every single one of them. And when you talk to them again and they took that test again, every single one of them improved. So we do know that they are mastering some subjects and moving on, but the schools need to sit down with all the experts and say, what are the competencies? New Hampshire cherishes local control. What are the competencies I want?
All right. Let me invite our listeners to join us. And then a lot more to look at, gentlemen. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at new ways to approach education from that time-honored, classroom-based, credit-based, time-in-the-seat-based system to a broader, more competency-based system. We invite you with your questions and comments. Do you see a need to move education away from traditional schedules, traditional ways of measuring, or do these structures still exist because they largely work? Have some of the changes that we're talking about occurred already in your own local schools? In your opinion, how are they working? What's come up? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. From the Fenton Family Dealerships in Keene, Toyota, Volvo, Honda, Subaru, and Hyundai, treating the needs of each individual customer with singular concern, fentondealerships.com. And from Verus Wealth Partners, a sustainable wealth management firm dedicated to aligning investors' financial objectives with their mission and values. Values Wealth Sustainability, VerusWP.com. More on a fundamental change in helping students learn on The Exchange on NHPR, then attend on The Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. role in Afghanistan after 2014. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly cloudy, some breaks of sunshine, highs around 50 in the North Country, ranging to 60 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, proposals for changing education from a time and classroom-based system to a competency-based system. We invite you to join us with your questions or comments at 1-800-892-6477 or email us exchange@nhpr.org. And Fred Bramante and George Strout, before we go to our listeners, I did want to ask you, Fred, about something George said just before the break. He talked about making this new approach work within local control. That's a very important principle toward education that we honor here in New Hampshire.
Sure. And to me, the most local of local control is the kids and their parents. And so you know, that's one of the bigger issues that I have had with how we've done this job. And when I say we, I talk about the State Board of Education and the department. I'm very proud of what the State Board has done and the Department of Ed. They've done a fantastic job. The part that I have an issue with is that it's still the best kept secret in the state of New Hampshire. Now, it's nice to see it on the front page of today's Union Leader. And you're talking about getting this national award. But ultimately, you know, the system should be driven by the parents and the kids. And you know, when Lionel Tracy talked about follow the child, that, you know, having the child be actually the leader of their own education, with the followers being the, you know, the educators, the and the community, the parents, helping to as a support staff in essence for that kid. So to me, the ultimate in local control is the kids and the parents.
Okay, and Fred, my ears went up when you said let the child be the leader of his or her own education.
Correct.
Okay, I've got two boys, as most people know, and boy, I feel like if I put them in charge of their education, they would try and do as little as possible, you know, so that they could go do something else that was, quote unquote, more fun.
Right. And no, I want them to do what is more fun. But I want a professional educator like George, saying, I'm not giving you credit until you master this. So it's higher standards than ever before. No more of this C's and D's and you get your credit. But envision a student's education that look like this. I want Mrs. Jones for English, but I'm going to use my karate lessons for my physical education. I'm going to play in a rock band for my music credit. I'm going to do world history online. I'm going to get my space science at the Krista McAuliffe Planetarium. I'm going to learn automotives at Grapponi Ford. All of the above. Now the entire community is pulled into the process of educating our kids, with our professional educators as the coordinators of the process and the upholders of high standards.
And that sounds awesome for that individual kid. But here's the but. Let's say George has 25 kids in his class, and all 25 kids are following.
Getting back to class again, though, Laura.
See,
it's like, do you know that out of the state regulations right now, we just, in the higher ed regulations, we just took out the word classroom?
I did not know that.
We just took out the word classroom. It now says learning environments.
Okay. So let me say that, let's say George has 25 kids in his learning environment.
All right.
And they all have these really cool, you know, designs that
really
you mentioned.
Really cool designs.
How does one man, George Stroud, our former math teacher here, how does he keep track of all that? George, how do you possibly manage 25 kids with all these admittedly really cool sounding education plans? You need like 10 people to keep track of that, right?
Notwithstanding the plan and how we can get there, I don't think the management of it or the oversight of it is the difficult part. There are plenty of tools and technologies that I am aware of, and I'm sure you're aware of, that we could do to keep track of the progress of all these students and where they are and what they're doing. The getting there is the part that I think that an educator is just going to want to sit back and go, okay, well, if I'm going to go to, you know, the karate teacher down the street from my gym class, well, what were those competencies? And how do I know that this individual, you know, has all of those? How do I know that this person is cleared? Have they gone through a background check? We're not talking about a private education here. This is taxpayer money that, you know, for public education that we've all banded together in the first place to say it's really important for our society, really important for our state, really important for everyone that we educate our kids. We're all willing to pony up and pay for that. And now we're all willing to maybe step in and help share some of our knowledge. But how do I make sure there's some transparency, there's some accountability, all the things that we have to do in a public school setting in a situation that starts to move away from that?
Right. So I can tell you're dying to jump in, Fred. But so the gym teacher, for example, at your school is certified, knows what he or she is supposed to do, you know, has the expertise to impart the knowledge and so forth.
The agreed upon competencies, the measurements for those, how I know the child has mastered them.
So now you have to not only hire that person, but also make sure that the karate guy down the street does it right, or the gymnastics gal down the street does it right. And how do you possibly find time to do all that for 25 children? You can't do that by yourself, can you?
I'm assuming that if this were the – I'm placing myself – I'm fast-forwarding how many ever years it takes to get to this place.
Hopefully and, not long.
And I'm looking at that and I'm saying, okay, this is my environment that I have. I'm going to assume that all of this work has been done. That, you know, when I worked in a business, we had certified suppliers. We knew who we could buy from. We knew who we couldn't buy from. We knew what they had to go through. And I'm assuming that this is the approach or something similar to that a community would take to say, you know, if I have a music studio or I have a dance studio and I've been teaching for 13 years, And now I want my kids to be able to get some credit for that. Here's the process that I would go through.
Got it.
I'm assuming it would be a whole lot like getting certified for a teacher and every 3 years going through it again. And but again, where are the standards? Where are the measurements? Making sure those are all there. And if the community agrees upon it, hey, children learn, you know. But again, I'm still struck by we do need to have that coordinator, that professional educator at the core of this to make sure that, you know, all the public money and funds that are being spent are being done the right way.
Go ahead, Fred.
I absolutely agree. But it's a different system than the one that we're now that everybody knows and loves or hates. And so when George talks about, you know, the different tasks, yes, those are the different tasks. We right now spend more than $500 billion a year, as big as the U.S. military, on public education, on a 20th century system. We now have to start changing our focus and looking at getting into a 21st century system. We have to start thinking about managing the abundance that's around us, managing what do we have. It's in the state regulations, harnessing the assets of the community. You know, what do you have for business assets? What do you have for not-for-profits? What do you have for talented individuals? What are the science-based assets in our community? The arts assets? What are the fitness assets? How do we harness all of that for the benefit of our kids? And it's a different job for our professional educators. And I'll tell you another one more that I think is going to surprise a lot of people. In the teacher training regulations, this is 500 and 600 regulations, we have pretty much taken out the word teacher. It now says educator. So we are looking at a process of training people to be coordinators, facilitators of this process. It's a different job. It'll be a better job for teachers. It'll be more fun for kids. Our kids will perform at levels beyond their wildest dreams when they get to own their learning. And if our educators are going to hold them to high standards, then miracles will start to happen. And, you know, I often say, where are you going to create the next space scientist? Are you going to create it in a high school classroom or at the Krista McAuliffe Planetarium? It's not even close. Why try?
And a question about cost, though, Fred. I mean, now, under this system, you have to pay the science teacher at the high school, but you also have to pay the folks at the McAuliffe-Shepherd Discovery Center. So is this way more expensive?
Oh, no. It'd probably be less expensive.
How so?
Because ultimately, kids will get through high school faster than they do now. It's not going to be about grades 1 through 12. It becomes a move-on-when-ready model, so that a kid might be at fifth grade level in language arts and third grade level in science. And when kids can start getting their credit in middle school, their high school credits in middle school, that we've talked at the Department of Ed about having the average kid finish high school by what would traditionally have been known as their sophomore year, and then if they want to stay to play, play sports or whatever else, then you start immersing higher ed into high school, so that they can walk out of high school with an associate's degree. I mean, we save parents tens of thousands of dollars in college education. To me, this is the future.
Let's go to our callers. Lots of people want to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is welcome to exchange@nhpr.org. First up is Mark in Portsmouth. Hi, Mark. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Laura.
Guy, hi, go ahead.
My concern is the taxpayer. In Portsmouth, we keep trying to go to a lower class size. I think it's like 18-1. And I'm not an educator, but to my knowledge, there's no evidence that class size matters after third grade, no studies. So what this gentleman is talking about, it sounds just like another educational fad, but with no evidence to back it up. I mean, the taxpayer can't afford small class sizes, especially if there's no proof that they work.
So relate that to...
I don't hear any proof coming from this gentleman.
Yeah, so your question, Mark, is how do we know that this works? Is that what you're trying to get at?
How do we know it's just not another educational fad, of which there have been so many? I'm 60 years old, and the number of educational fads we've gone through is just phenomenal.
Yeah, I hear
and
you
the,
there.
Each of them seem to get more expensive to the taxpayer. I hear him say it's going to be less expensive, but I'm sorry, I don't believe him. Evidence just tells me that isn't so.
Well, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And again, related to this cost question, Fred, say what you will about the current system, at least it's efficient. You know, everybody's there, and you don't have to hire five different people to teach the same subject or present the same information.
It's not efficient. It's inefficient. You know, if a student doesn't need the 180 days to master the required competencies, then to keep them in those seats longer than the time required to get to that point costs more money than to do it based on competencies. The you know, I always say, why does the kid who is running track, why does that student have to go to gym class? Why does the student who's taking private piano lessons have to go to music class? So you look at all these other opportunities where, you know, you can do this way more efficiently than we're currently doing it. I think that, you know, if we could get the average student to finish high school by the time they're 16, which they do in Europe, in most of the countries, as I understand it, then we make, if we knocked off 2 years of public education, we make it less expensive. Now, personally, from my standpoint, I would want to go to our taxpayers and say to them, if I can prove to you that I can make this cheaper in high school, I want some of the money back for preschool, because I think that we ought to be institutionalizing preschool in this state. But let's make it cheaper first. At the high school level, so that we save taxpayer dollars, and that the overall cost is it's ultimately a win for everybody.
Well, and George Stroud, I appreciate Mark's point about, is this yet another education reform? I mean, it does seem like every 2-3 years somebody has some great idea that's going to bring nirvana to our schools, and I mean, you do sort of get jaded after a while. What do you think? Is this just, you know, flavor of the month, so to speak?
Well, you know, I mean, as a professional educator, you always welcome the new ideas, and you always look at them as, you know, what can they bring, and there's value in it, and where can we go with the things that are valuable, where can we question things we don't understand, and where do things maybe not work, and can we go prove that? But my concern, as I listen to the rest of the plan here, is that, you know, the promise of public education was that not everyone can afford the karate lessons or the dance lessons or the private music,
right,
or all those other things that are going on, and the communities have decided – it's important for every child to be educated, so we're all going to band together, and we're all going to pay for public education. So there's a slippery slope for me as we start moving down this road, is that, are we starting to deconstruct that promise moving forward? And that's where I would need to – you got to put your book on Kindle, okay, so I could read the whole thing for the technological person here. But so that's my concern as I hear this going forward, not so much the cost or the fad, but what the direction is we're going in, and will we serve everyone, even those people who can't afford these private things?
That's a fundamental – important philosophical question that you're asking, George. And Fred, what do you think? Are we deconstructing this fundamental social contract that all our children deserve to be educated?
Absolutely not. We're deconstructing, hopefully, a dinosaur of a model, but we are not deconstructing that social contract. We're going to strengthen that social contract more than ever before, because we are going to create a personalized, customized learning experience for every single kid. Now, in New Hampshire, as in other states, we call what we call differentiated aid. We already, you know, if Johnny has, you know, either learning disabilities or is on free and reduced lunch or is has English as a second language, then there are extra monies given to that school district for that kid. If Johnny moves from District A to District B, that money follows him to District B. The problem is that when he gets to District B, that money gets commingled with the rest of the monies, and you know, and it doesn't necessarily get used for Johnny's purposes. I believe that we have to be looking at an education funding model that also talks about following the child. And that if private karate lessons are deemed as the right thing to do for, you know, for this this child who cannot afford it, then I think that money had his name on it. So, you know, I say we start using it.
Well, Mark, thanks a lot for that call. And let's go next to Ossipee, where Kevin's waiting. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call. I'll just make a couple of quick comments and then get off and listen to the commentators. I agree with Fred. I think that our system is outdated. I think it's a dinosaur. I believe that it's a machine that has gained such momentum and such strength in the budgetary things that we have to allot to it that we're afraid to attack this monster. So I'm also going to approach this from a homeschool perspective. I know that that's sometimes a negative word in the educational circles, but I think that this very much patterns this idea that we're talking about, that the individual student is the one that matters, and what they're interested in and how they'll be educated it depends a lot on the input, and they can be helping to determine their input. We've done that. I think the overall testing that was mentioned by the SAT scores, by the spelling bees, by leadership and so forth of these students when they come out is a key element to see, yeah, this is working. How it'll be paid for. I think that the one critique of homeschooling is that it's not necessarily done by folks who are qualified to do it. And so that's a concern for us. We have, though, outside certified educators who then check progress once a year to make sure that the student is indeed progressing in the areas they need to progress in. So there are checks and balances. But I think that the idea, for example, of having a student who loves motorcycles and wants to learn about them, and we can teach the math behind it, the torque and the conversion, the gear ratios, and we can teach sociology or social studies regarding the development of it, and then a bunch of other related subjects. But that student will just excel at that. They'll eat it up. We've seen it happen. And
so you're a homeschooling parent,
we are,
Kevin.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, how many kids?
Well, we have 7 right now.
Wow.
But we have 3 that are foster children, so we're not educating them at home.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, Kevin. I wonder what sort of model you think, George, homeschooling offers when we look at making these changes in the broader public education system.
I think parents know their children better than anyone, and I think teachers are probably second for the amount of time that we spend with them. And a parent has absolutely every right to decide, that they're going to – how they're going to educate, their child. The concern I have, though, is just how – if the parent wants to do that, then the parent is going to pay for that. And that's yay, one thing. Two, it was good to hear that there's a certified educator involved somehow in this process, because while the motorcycle, given in the example, might be the hook, might be the very interesting thing to get the child in there, there's more math than just what goes on in a motorcycle and more background in social studies and sociology that are associated with the culture of motorcycle. If that's the hook to get them in, yay. But then you got to expand it to the rest of the curriculum.
Yeah, and I've got another question based on Kevin's call. And Kevin, thank you so much. We'll take more of your calls after a short break at 1-800-892-6477 or email at exchange@nhpr.org.
NHPR is proud to bring you classical music on the radio once again. Classical New Hampshire brings you music and performance from some of the world's great orchestras like the New York Philharmonic and the Chicago Symphony, plus weekly broadcasts of the Metropolitan Opera live from Lincoln Center. You can tune in at 91.5 FM in the Capital Region, on HD Radio at WEVO 89.1 HD2, and online at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Cambridge Trust Company of New Hampshire, building lasting relationships and providing thoughtful, independent investment, trust, and wealth management services. CambridgeTrust.com. And from TransCanada, generating and selling electricity, and a proud supporter of New Hampshire's Audubon's initiative to restore nesting bald eagles in the Connecticut River watershed. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new approach to education that emphasizes competency, mastery of a subject, over how many hours a student may spend in class. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Do you see a need to move public education away from traditional schedules, traditional measurements, or do these structures still exist because they largely work? As we've been talking, some of these changes are already taking place in New Hampshire. If they've taken place in your local schools, tell us how you think they're working out. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Fred Bramante, before we go back to our phones, I did want to follow up with something Kevin, our homeschooling parent, talked about. He mentioned the idea that you know, and you've said this too, a customized system for every kid, and kids are interested in different things and they learn differently. So why put all the, you know, round pegs in square holes and so forth? But the real world doesn't customize its approach for you. I can't come into New Hampshire Public Radio and say, you know, I'm not really good at math, so I really don't want to, you know, add up how many seconds it's going to take for me to read this billboard. I want somebody else to do that, okay? Is that all right? The real world isn't going to accommodate me and my little quirks, and so should kids have to suck it up and learn how to do things in a different way? Are we coddling to them? Are we catering to them too much? And the real world isn't going to cater to them.
I think it's, you know, we know from the My Voice survey that 53% of boys and 52% of boys and 43% of girls say school's boring. So, you know, how much are they learning if they're sitting there bored? And so I want to take the word boredom out of learning. Learning is fun. It's exciting if you love what you're learning. Kevin gets it. I have had someone say to me, what you're talking about is homeschooling with professional oversight. Well, for some, that's what it'll be. But that's like the best of all worlds. For others, it'll be classrooms. If, you know, if they want the traditional classroom approach, then the traditional classroom approach will still be there. I think you're going to have in 5 years or less in New Hampshire, 95% of our kids in a blended model. It'll be some online, mm-hmm. it'll be some real world, and it'll be some classroom. That is what the future of public education will be. And so, you know, when you asked about George, how are you going to do all this by yourself? He's not going to do it by himself.
In other words, keep track of 25 kids with 25 different schedules.
There are going to be more adults engaged with kids than ever before, but they're not all going to be professional educators. They are going to be talented individuals in our communities. The business community is going to be involved. The not-for-profits are going to be involved. So ultimately, we have to pull together all the resources of our community, all coordinated by our professional educators. It'll be a better job than ever before. And and why would any kid drop out of school if they get to own their learning and own their timetable? And so to me, you hook into a kid's passion, whether it's motorcycles, like Kevin said, or basketball or whatever, you can attach it to real world stuff. And the job of that professional educator is to get that kid in, you know, hook them first, and then stretch them, get them to dream and believe beyond what they would have done on their own. That's what the purpose of the professional educator will be.
What do you think about this question, George? Again, you know, we keep talking about a customized system for every kid, but the real world isn't customized for Fred or George or Laura or anybody else. So what do you think about that?
I think that that's the value of having somebody show up and work with other people. We'll use an instrument, for example. If I played the trumpet, I could actually show one person that I have competency in that instrument. But can I play in a small ensemble? Can I play in a large group? Those are different altogether. And, you know, those are things that school, the traditional model, offers right now because of the interaction that you have. And educators, I just left. I know that they try to find those hooks. They try to find for every student that these are incredibly dedicated professional people who are doing the best they can every day.
No argument. I just wanted them to have more tools than ever before. That's all I'm looking for.
Let's take another call. This is Becky in Henniker. Hi, Becky. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a lifetime high school teacher, and I've taught in independent schools, not public schools. But one thing I would comment on is that a lot of our schools are based around a culture of distrust, and we don't really trust our high schoolers, at least, to make great decisions. And we know adolescents can make foolish decisions, of course. but I do think students respond much better to a system where there's more expected of them, and that, as your guest has said, they can own their decisions. And the school will respond to what they need and what they want. A large classroom and a set curriculum really doesn't respond in many ways. You've got your teacher responding to each student, but the curriculum itself is not responsive. So I really am moved and excited about this idea of the move on when ready model. It makes a lot of sense to me in my 20-some years of teaching.
All right.
And I think that's what we do anyway with students, although we have to sort of treat them in a group. But I think the best teachers are dealing with 20 or 25 or 18 individuals.
Becky, thanks a lot, and good to hear from you, given your long experience in education. George, what do you think?
I was going to say, I think what Becky was going at the end was is what we would do, what we do. If I have kids who have mastered what we've worked on, they're not sitting there not doing anything. They're moved on to other things. I mean, I still have a curriculum. I still have competencies that have to be taught. I still have a core that needs to be put out there. But if I have kids who have moved beyond that, they're not just sitting there doing nothing. They're moving on, and it's a professional job for a professional person to keep track of 18 to 30 people at different levels. But that's what we do. And that's what's done every day in every classroom that I saw.
So again, this gets back to your earlier point that a lot of this is happening already. It's just those of us who are outside the system don't understand.
If they've already gone and defined the competencies, this is happening already, and most schools have.
Fred, a question that Becky raises about trust, and I do have that question for you. How do you know that students are doing what they're supposed to be doing? I don't want to be cynical, but, you know, I heard recently about a high school student who was supposed to be doing coursework online. And, of course, mom and dad trusted that, you know, this student was. And then turns out, whoops, they're goofing off, you know, playing computer games or going on Facebook or whatever. So how do you keep track of these kids that they really are doing that VLACS, that Virtual Learning Academy history course?
Well, I mean, if you're expecting that this turns every kid into a saint, I don't think that
that's
going to happen. No, but I do expect that you know that issues that we have traditionally had, discipline issues in schools, that is going to diminish because the kids many kids will not be in those environments. They'll be in environments that they like being in, and I expect that kids are going to have schedules. So if they're supposed to be at Grapponi's Ford to learn their automotives, there's a schedule for them. If they're supposed to be someplace else, there's a schedule for them. So it doesn't mean that there's no schedule and this is just helter-skelter. That's not going to be the case. But ultimately, we have to work to get there. And, you know, and we are getting there. I will tell you, we are getting there. That's why we've been given this award. And the stuff that you're hearing George say, it's happening. It is happening more in New Hampshire than any other state in the United States, and that's why we've been given this award. I am convinced we are scratching the surface of what the possibilities are, and that we can do a lot more. We've got a great, dedicated group of individuals, our professional educators, who came to this profession because they wanted to change kids' lives. We have the team we want. You know, when I hear people say bad teachers, you know, I have a hard time with that. I have, to me, it's bad system. You know, that it's like, you know, we've asked a lot of these people to herd cats. That's what that's what it's like in many cases. This is not an easy job. I think that
my question has been all along, Fred, is that, you know, again, I don't want to keep asking it, but is one person like George enough to do this for, you know, 20 kids?
George is not going to do it by himself.
George is going to have a team. People?
No, George is going to have a team of people working with him that are not employees of the school district.
Let me give you an email here from Lori, who asked the question that I had earlier. So, Lori, thanks for raising it. She says, interaction within the community sounds great in the cities. Where are the resources in the rural towns, populations under 1,000? This came up when we were talking about, George, I believe you taught in Salem. Is that where
That's
you
correct.
Taught? And here we are talking right now in Concord. So two communities with, you know, lots of businesses and nonprofits and karate studios or whatever, to keep using that example. What do you think about that, George?
Well, that could be an issue that we need to look at. I mean, I agree that that would be a problem. And again, we're faced with the, you know, what is the promise of public education again, and how do we serve that the best way we can, no matter where you live. You know, that being said, there are plenty of resources that are out there that are available online. There are other things that someone can do to explore if they're interested in something and start them down that path. And to the trust issue, you know, if you've been goofing off, you still have to master a competency. The day will come. There's a day of reckoning that whenever it is, whether I'm in a traditional setting or not, here's the day of reckoning. The competency is in front of you. Can you master it? No, I can't. You're still here then.
So under this new way of approaching education,
current way,
mm-hmm. for sure, but you have to, is there a test, I mean, at some point? Or do I have to come before you and say, George, here's how I,
Well, it depends on what it is. I mean, clearly if it's an instrument or a sport or in a lab setting, you'd play. If it's something a little bit more mathematical, maybe there's a problem that you have to solve in an open-ended way. But you have to perform or show this mastery of the competency at what we would call the day of reckoning. And that's just – you know, goof off, but you're still not going to get past this.
You know, Massachusetts, Fred, has, I think it's called the MCAS, a test that you have to pass. You have to pass it in order to get your high school diploma. Are you talking about that here?
Not necessarily. No, we Massachusetts, there are two consortiums in the United States around assessment. One of them, the test is the 800-pound gorilla, and Massachusetts is in that consortium. We're in the consortium that is called the Smarter Balance Consortium. And New Hampshire looks at this and says there's more than one way to judge mastery than just some kind of a bubble test at the end of whatever the period is. So yes, I want mastery, but I accept that there are more than one way to demonstrate mastery. So you talked about a musician. Could you fill in a bubble test and write down the notes of a particular scale? I guess you could. I'd rather see you play it.
Absolutely. Well, sure, and that's an obvious example. Right. But then you've got, you know, math and science and English. And,
great.
You know, I mean,
I'd rather have you apply. I don't want you filling in a test to demonstrate that you can pass this test, and then 2 weeks later you forgot everything. That's not mastery. Mastery is knowing something beyond the test, knowing something so that you can apply it in known and unknown situations in the future. That's what mastery is.
Let's see if we can get one more call in here, gentlemen. And this is Beth in Bedford. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And my question pertains to, you talk about sending them out to Grapponi or a karate school. Is that then paid for by the taxpayers? And then what if the taxpayers don't like the philosophy or whatever of that organization? We're in Bedford. We had you did a report on the IB program, our International Baccalaureate. People don't like that it's governed outside of the state. How do you deal with those kinds of things? That's my question.
Beth, it's a good question. Thank you very much. Fred?
I expect that I will be paying for my kids to take private piano lessons or whatever else. The issue that George raised about fairness for kids whose parents can't afford it, that has to be addressed. So there's another way that ultimately parents are going to be paying for some of these things. That I mean, there's certainly going to be options inside of the school that are free, as they always have been. And if you want to do something else, in some cases you'll pay for it. But in other cases, as I said, for kids who can't afford it, that we need to make sure that this doesn't become, another issue of haves and have-nots. So I think again, there will be decisions made at the local levels. I think that people are going to have a hard time arguing on some of this. Some of this stuff because you're going to have, once the parents and the kids find out what's inside the New Hampshire regulations and the options that they have before them, then I think this never goes back. Once this system was designed to move control of the system of public education from the system itself and move a hunk of that control to the parents and the students so that there's this shared responsibility, shared ownership, because the school ultimately is not going to, as George was saying, we're not giving credit until you prove mastery. But now the student has and the parents have choices. It's the ultimate in school choice. Now, instead of picking school A or school B, you get to pick, how do I want my math? How do I want my language arts? How do I want my science? This kills, as far as I'm concerned, the issue of vouchers. This is way better than vouchers would ever be. And it's still public education.
Here's an email from Ray in Silver Lake. He says, learning at your own speed is very doable, and we should offer opportunities to prove and demonstrate mastery. Ray also says, though, learning can happen everywhere, and guidance can be accessed via school. The issue of supervision would have to be addressed. He says, who is responsible for a 15-year-old studying with his girlfriend, unsupervised, off school premises? What do you think, George? This gets back to that trust issue.
It does get back to that trust issue, and I think it gets back to what we as educators see all the time. I mean, we said earlier, parents know their kids the best, and educators try lots of times to interact with parents. We don't always have the greatest success, and that becomes a barrier. Sometimes kids come to school hungry. Sometimes kids come to school they're not clothed properly. Sometimes kids come to school and as mandatory reporters, we have to bring things up because it looks like perhaps this child is not in the best circumstance. That, I don't think, is going to be immediately addressed with the kind of a program that we're talking about here. But again, you do open a door to a question that needs to be answered. Once a child hits the bus or the school property, you know, we're responsible.
Right.
And there are a lot of things we have to do. If that's going on during the day without any supervision, who is responsible? Don't know.
All right. Well, Fred, super quick, if you could, where do you see this off-the-clock movement heading from here on out?
It's going to spread across the country. I consult for other departments of education and go to other states and talk to people, and they change their regulations. They start moving in the same direction New Hampshire is. So this is the future of public education. We still have a long way to go, but we are getting there.
Thanks for being here, both of you gentlemen. I enjoyed talking with you. Lots of calls and emails. Thank you so much, Fred Bramani.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Fred Bramani, former chair of the New Hampshire Board of Education, co-author of the new book, Off the Clock, Moving Education from Time to Competency. George Strout, it was good to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
George Strout, communications coordinator for the New Hampshire chapter of the National Education Association and a former high school math teacher. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Pinoy.